everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Talk of Gasoline Alley. We'll be here for the next 2 hours, taking your questions of a nostalgic nature about the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the 500-mile race. The number to call is 1-800-603-6453, 1-800-603-6453. Well, we just completed Community Day here at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and it's a wonderful opportunity for families to come here because they can, not only are there a lot of activities and drivers signing autographs all kinds of things for the people to do. The real attraction, I would think, is the fact that they can come in the garage area. You don't need a credential. It's over now, but you can come out here with your families, and it's just it's a wonderful opportunity for the general public who would not normally have access to the place, that they're able to come in here and come around and just see the garage area. We'll just see Little Al's mom just walking by here. we're coming to you live from the garage area at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. The gates are pretty much closed now, so everybody is kind of leaving, although the teams are still here. And, I thought that was Tony Kanaan, but he's got hair, so that's not Tony Kanaan, but he's carrying a Kanaan uniform. But anyway, we're winding down. It's a beautiful summer evening or late spring evening, and we're out here basking just outside of the Dryan Reinbold garage, and we really want to thank the Dryan Reinbold racing team for allowing us to use their facility for the entire month. Robbie Buell and Dennis Reinbold, the principals, and their drivers, with Buddy Rice, Townsend Bell, and Milka Duno, who was signing her. She has a new book out, and she was signing that today. Apparently that one did very well. Anyway, 1-800-603-6453 is the number to call. 1-800-603-6453. And we have Kim on the phone. Good evening. Thanks for calling in.
Good afternoon, or good evening by now. I just wanted to thank you. About 8 years ago, I was working for the St. Pete Times, and you helped me out on a story I was doing on Granatelli, and you let me interview you, and you helped me get a hold of Mr. Granatelli, which was a very hard task at the time.
Really? Yeah. Very accessible to the press.
Well, I had gotten several other numbers, and some of them were going through his grandkids, and they didn't prove to be real forthcoming for some reason. I never did figure out why. But
I don't know how you got to them. If you can get to him, you get all the interview you want.
Well, it was a thrill of a lifetime for me. I mean, I've been listening to you since you came to the Speedway in the 60s.
Thank you.
And I've been thinking a lot about Jimmy Clark after Frank Heedy's win last year, and you know, 40 years and the turbines. I know you were never a big turbine fan. I was a 12-year-old kid, and I just dug the heck out of them. They were just, you know, so different.
Well,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, they were great for the sport. There's no question that they drew a tremendous amount of attention and probably brought some people to the racetracks that might not otherwise have come. And maybe some of them just came to see the curiosity and then left. And then others, maybe they got hooked by the sport and stayed. So I think they were good for the sport.
Yes, and I, you know, I had been a Granatelli fan since the Novi's, when I was about probably 6 or 7. And so it's probably 63, I'm guessing. And we were in one of the underpasses under the main straightaway, and the Novi went over. And I remember going over, but I remember my dad saying my eyes got as big as dinner plates from the sound of those cars. They were so wonderful.
Yeah.
But, it's just, there's two things that make living in Indiana worthwhile, and one is the month of May, and the second one is tomatoes out of the garden in the summertime.
Okay, well, to clarify what you said about what I said about the turbines, I mean, actually, I wasn't that crazy about that because I didn't want to see everything change to the point where in a year or two it was going to be 33 turbines. I don't think anybody would have wanted to see that.
And no.
That was my concern. As long as there was one or two, that was okay. And So anyway, I know that you know, a lot of people loved them, and they as I say, they brought a lot of people into the sport that might otherwise have come.
So. Definitely true. When you're getting on the Tonight Show at that point, like they did, you're doing a wonderful thing for the sport.
Oh well, you can get on the Tonight Show if you sponsor it, and that's how that was done.
Oh, okay.
STP
okay.
Corporation bought time on the show, so. Not to say that it wouldn't have happened anyway, but I think Andy was on as a guest, I think like two or three times, and then they got Johnny Carson came here in the fall of 67 to drive a couple of laps with the Turban, but that was all tied into buying time on the show.
I see. Well, if you would ever want to read that story I did on them, you can go to the Safety Times website and type in keyword search Granatelli, and it'll come right up.
Okay.
And you were a wonderful help, and I will always be ever so grateful to you for that. So
well, you're very welcome.
Much.
Okay, thanks for calling in.
Thank
okay,
you.
Kim, thanks for the call. Back to the phones, and Scott, you're up next.
Hi there, Donald.
Yes, sir.
Enjoy listening to this show. First time I've called in.
Okay, well, great.
I was calling about my hometown is Columbus, Indiana.
Yep.
And I don't live there anymore, but I probably always consider it my home.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering about the various connections that the city has had with the 500 over the years. The two that I know about or know something about are Cummins Engine Company,
mm-hmm.
you know, both as a supplier of an engine for the cars, as well as a sponsor.
Yep.
And then Tony Stewart as a driver. But
okay.
I'm sure you have some other ones? No.
I do. Yeah.
I'll hang up and listen to you. Thanks.
All right. The first one I thought of was Larry Crockett, who was not born there, but lived there for his from quite early on in his life, and he was the 1954 Rookie of the Year, and sadly, 54 was his only appearance. He was a hot rod driver, a track roadster driver right after the war, and he drove sprint cars, and I think he won three features in 1953, and was fifth in the points, and that earned him a ride at the Speedway for Federal Engineering, and he finished ninth. He was the seventh fastest qualifier, although he qualified on the last day, so he was back in the pack. And so when he finished ninth, there was no question as to who was the Rookie of the Year. And he ran the rest of the championship season. And the real surprise was that he went to the Pikes Peak Hill Climb that he'd never even been out there before. And he was the fastest qualifier, beating all the locals, all the regulars. And he finished fourth, but he was the fastest qualifier. And then for the following year, Curtis ordered a new roadster for him, and he never got to drive it because he lost his life in a sprint car race at Langhorne, Pennsylvania, March 17th, 1955. But anyway, you mentioned Cummins Diesel, and then, of course, Tony Stewart was born there and now actually lives there. Columbus, Indiana, there was a driver named Bobby Black who drove sprint cars, and he used to hang out at the garage here and wanted to drive and would shop his services, but never got a bite. That's about all I can think of now as far as drivers. I think Paul Brooks, who was a great mechanic, might have been from there because he used to wrench a sprint car that was Columbus Auto Parts Special. We'll think a few more when we come back after the break. Anyway, we are going to take a break, and when we come back, you're going to have one of the 30 Days of May features with Sid Collins. We've been getting a lot of compliments on those, and we'd love to hear from you with a question of a nostalgic nature about the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. The number to call is 1-800-603-6453, 1-800-603-6453. We'll take care of some business. We'll hear Sid, and then we'll be back and take your calls. You're listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan.
This is Sid Collins at the starting line, alongside with veteran reporter Jim Shelton, to talk with two of the most popular drivers of their time. Jim chatted with him like this in 1957.
We have another man who's in number two position, and he's happy because he didn't even get in the race last year, but he's in it this year, that's for sure. Eddie Stacks, boy, where are you from, first of all?
Allentown, Pennsylvania.
Boy, we hope they're listening to you over WHOL today, and you turned in 144.648 today, and that puts you in number two position. Of course, your good friend Freddie Agabation is in the other position in the front row.
That's right. He's in the third spot.
Now, you drive the Peter Schmidt special. That's number 88, right?
That's right, from St. Louis, Missouri, and it's a mechanic by Joe Langley from Indianapolis.
Boy, we want to give the mechanics a pat on the back because they certainly deserve it. Give his name again.
Joe Langley from Indianapolis, Indiana, and I might say that the man did a wonderful job because he unloaded the car at the speedway, put it in the garage, and has never laid a wrench on it until we qualified.
Is that a fact?
That's right, sir.
You know, most of the people think they work over these cars night and day, but you didn't yours.
Well, my mechanic told me, he said, what the heck? He said, I worked all winter.
So it was in good shape. Eddie Sachs, the best of good luck to you.
Right.
Hey, let's get back and say the best of good luck to you, Pat O'Connor. We're happy for you.
Thank you very much. I don't know if any time in my life I've been any more happier than I am right now.
To Eddie Sachs, to Pat O'Connor, and to their crews, best of luck on race day.
That was Jim Shelton talking with 1957 pole sitter Pat O'Connor and racing's clown prince Eddie Sachs during those 30 days in May.
We're back with the talk of Gasoline Alley, and we love to hear those things. We've only got a couple more to go. Just programming note, we're here for 2 hours. Actually, on 1070 The Fan, we have to leave the air at 7:30, but the program will continue on Network Indiana. For those of you that are out there in the various towns where you're picking us up, but as far as the general audience, 1070, we have to depart at 7:30. And then tomorrow we do the 2 hours, and then on Friday night there is no 6 to 7 segment, but we will be here from 7 to 8 because the heavyweights are on from 6 to 7. All right, we got all kinds of callers hanging on, so let's go to the phones. And Don, thanks for calling in.
Hello, Donald.
Yes, sir.
Boy, you make my month of May. You really do.
Thank you.
And that was a perfect lead-in for my question. My question is, where did the term or the nomenclature for the special, how was that developed, and why did it end? When I was growing up as a child, every car was a special.
Yeah, I know. I love that.
And I'm just going to guess that term finally ended when teams, so in other words, it was Team Penske or Team Ganassi or something along that nature that the term ended. Anyway, I'm going to hang up and listen to your response. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Okay. All right. Well, I think the term special first was used at the Speedway and in other championship races in 1913, and it's because cars were it was supposed to be stripped down versions of passenger cars, but they were starting to push the envelope. They were being modified, so they really weren't. They were getting further and further from what they actually were, and so it was decided that they should all be called specials. But at the time, it was like Stutch special, Dallaire special, and Maxwell special, whatever the make of car was. And then after the war, mid-20s is when you first started to see companies sponsoring cars. And they were automotive related through to about the late 1920s. So you had the boil valve special and the state auto insurance special, which arguably is automotive related. Then there was the Miller Majestic special, which was for Majestic radios, for which maybe, I don't know if they had car radios or not, but then you get into the 1930s, and then the floodgates open, and you had all these non-automotive products. When it went away, it first started to, I know that Bob Wilkie, his cars, as far as he was concerned, were not Leader-Card specials, but Leader-Card roadsters, and with a capital R. And then you found that with the rear engine cars that teams would use the type of the chassis. So you'd have the Wagner Lockheed brake fluid Eagle and the American Red Bull Shrike And I'm just using those as hypotheticals, but, Gatorade, McLaren, and now I'm getting into commercialism here, but, still some outfits call theirs the specials, but really there's only been a couple in recent years. I'd say that the term special was dying out, probably late 70s. And, so, yeah, I used to love the car names, and now it's a little bit complicated, so I sort of gave up on trying to memorize those a few years ago, but I used to know them all. And I agree with you, that was just a neat part of it. I loved a Sea Snack Shrimp Cocktail Special was a favorite of mine, and I had others. Shore Stop Mechanical Brake Equalizer Special was a favorite. Hollywood Payday Candy Bar Special. Anyway, Silver Floss Sauerkraut Special. That was a good one. That was Roger McCluskey in 75. Anyway, we thank you very much indeed for the call. And Brent, you're next. Good evening.
Good evening, Donald. I'm a big fan of yours. I've listened to you ever since the late 60s, early 70s, when my dad would have your show on the way home from the track.
Oh, thanks.
I have two things to ask you about, and then I'll hang up and listen. First of all, I guess it's not really a rumor that Aldo Andretti took the actual photos, the day after photos, in place of Mario in 69 due to the facial burns that he had, I assume.
Yep, that's correct.
And also, I'd like you to talk, and I don't think I've heard this much or any this month, about Pat Vidan. We were always big fans of his style, the way he flagged, and I've done a little reading on him, kind of his background, but especially what he did at Indianapolis.
Okay, sure. To cover what you said about Aldo, Aldo was Mario's twin brother, and he's the father of John Andretti. And in 1969, actually the first qualifying weekend was effectively completely rained out. And on the Wednesday between the two weekends, Mario was out with the car that he intended to qualify, which was the four-wheel drive Lotus with a turbocharged Ford, and he had a hellacious accident. And he escaped with flash burns on his cheeks. And then that Saturday, which was the third qualifying day, but the first one in which anybody completed a run, he qualified for the middle of the front row between Foyt and Bobby Unser. And on the Sunday morning, they came out for the photographs of the front row. And Mario He didn't want to be photographed with the flash burns. In fact, in the qualifying shot, he kept the helmet and the face sock on, and it was pulled down so all you could see was his eyes. And he was just so self-conscious about it that he elected to have Aldo, his twin brother, come in for him. There were other occasions where the driver was not there. Ed Elysian didn't show up in 1958. Well, we haven't heard this for a while. The voice of Gasoline Alley. All right. In fact, I'll have to make this a two-parter because I've realized that we're coming up on a break. So we'll be back after the half-hour break here. You are listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. We're back with the Talk of Gasoline Alley, and I was so intent on listening to the voice of Gasoline Alley that we haven't heard the PA, I don't think, this month. In fact, I've had several people say, gee, we miss hearing the messages over the public address system in the garage area. But anyway, I think we covered everything, and what I was saying was that Ed Elysian did not show up for the photograph in 1958, and so Denny Moore, the chief mechanic, pulled on a helmet and sunglasses and sat in the car for the shot. And then I think Jim Clark was missing. I think Jim Clark didn't show when he was on the pole, and they put Dan Gurney in the car, I think, and there might have been a couple of others. Anyway, I think we're handled there, so we do have plenty of callers, so we'll try to get as many in as we can. Let's go to Mike. Good evening.
Hello, Donald. How are you this evening?
Fine, sir. Thank you.
Hey, I've been listening, well, for a long time, let's just put it this way. I got a question for you regarding one of those non-automotive special teams from the 30s.
Okay.
The car was, I believe, the cocktail hour cigarette special.
Yes.
And my great uncle, Earl Schmidt, was one of the owners, and I think he was involved with Hamilton Harris Vending Company. I think Ralph Hepburn may have driven for them once or twice. Just any information that you could plug in, I'd appreciate. I got my kids in the car, and I'll just hang up and kind of listen to what you have to say.
Okay, well, Hamilton Harris sponsored, they did Ralph Hepburn in 1937, and Tony Gallata in 38, and then Hepburn again in 39, which actually I think was that was the same car. Anyway, just those 3 years, and then the Cocktail Hour Cigarette Special, actually that was owned by Bill White, and so Cocktail was the sponsor, Al Gordon was the driver. And I don't know that I can tell you a lot more. I just know Hamilton Harris. And I'm not sure if it was Hamilton Harris or Hamilton and Harris. I think it was Hamilton Harris hyphenated. And it was a local company, I believe. In fact, this is just from the depths of my memory here. I think that when I first came to the area, there was a building downtown. It was a red brick building, and you could actually see very faint Hamilton and Harris on the wall, and I don't know if that might have been their building at some time. I'll have to check out and find out what the address was. But anyway, they did get second with Hepburn in 37 with Bob Swanson as a relief driver. In fact, that was the closest finish, 2.16 seconds. Hepburn almost caught Wilbur Shaw at the end because Shaw was trying to save the engine because his oil temperature was dropping to zero in the turns. And in the qualifying shot, there's two or three gentlemen in business suits and hats and ties. And I don't know if that was Hamilton and Harris, maybe, or even the gentleman that you mentioned. But anyway, let's keep moving on here. And Steve, you're up next.
Hey, Donald, how are you?
Fine, sir. Thank you.
Hey, listen, I just got a question for you. I've been listening to you since about 1970, but what was your most emotional victory lane speech? I'll tell you mine and see if we're on the same page. In 1986, when Ray Hall won the race, the first thing he said when he got out of the car was, "This one's for Jim Truman."
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Jim was very sick at the time. And I heard later on through the years that Jack Arulhead had wrote a book, and he made a point that he heard Jim Truman tell Ray Hall that he could leave now.
Oh, well, that was... there's several different ways to answer your question. I think the person that was the most emotional, and of course there's different ranges of emotion. Al Unser Jr., when he won the first time, and then also Mark Donahue was very emotional in the victory lane. But I think probably in terms of drama, it would be the 86 win, because everybody knew... quotes around everybody, but a lot of people, including many people in the stands, knew that Jim Truman was sick, and he was very popular because I remember that when Red Roof Inns first showed up on cars with Truman and Ray Hall when they came in 82, I know a lot of people from the Buckeye State just loved that that entry because they knew about the company, but also that Jim Truman had a fine reputation as being a square shooter. I mean, you never hear anything bad about Jim Truman, or at least I never had. And the fact that he was so sick, he was a fine looking man, but he obviously had deteriorated, majorly, if that's a term, when May of 60 or of 86 came around, and he sat out there in the sun all day with a hat with material over his neck to save for possible sunburn, and he stayed on there for the whole race. And then he did pose the day after the race, but he looked terribly thin. And a few days later, they had a parade in downtown Columbus and declared it. I think it was Jim Truman Day, I think, and he was too sick to attend too sick to attend the parade, and then he passed away 11 days later. So, yeah, I mean, that was a very emotional situation. Other emotional winners, as I say, I'd put Donahue up there, which you might not normally think, but his voice was cracking when he said it was the greatest moment of his life. And then also Fittipaldi got emotional the first time, and then Al Unser Jr., who was just about as euphoric as any winner you could ever imagine. Anyway, we got plenty more callers hanging on. The number to call is 1-800-603-6453. 1-800-603-6453. We'll be back in a few moments with more of the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. We're back with the Talk of Gasoline Alley, and let's go straight to the phones. Ron, thanks for hanging.
Hi, Donald. You'd asked me a couple weeks ago to get back with you about the unusual way that I met Ralph LaGore, and I'll tell you a quick little story. It is rather interesting.
Okay.
We used to go to a lot of sprint car races, and occasionally we'd go to the Indy cars also. So it was around, I think it was 1965, and we're decided to include the Phoenix race as part of our vacation, a group of us. So we're driving to western Oklahoma on the interstate, and we came up behind this station wagon pulling an enclosed what appeared to be a race car trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went on around and looked over, and it was Ralph. And, of course, recognized him right away, and he waved, and we pulled on around him, got in front of him for a ways, and he started blinking his lights at us.
Mm-hmm.
So I pulled over, and he pulled over, and I went back and said, hey, Ralph, how you doing? He said, fine. He said, would you get in and ride with me for a while? And I said, well, okay. So someone else took the wheel of my car. I got in with Ralph. He was pulling the Daimler car. And he told me he'd driven from Tampa to Indianapolis, picked up the race car with no sleep, was driving to Phoenix because they told him he could do some testing if he got there early enough with no sleep.
Uh-huh.
So I rode for about 300 miles with him, and he put it on about 85 to 90, and we were weaving down the interstate pulling this heavy trailer. He's got me looking for state police airplanes and park state police, and it was the wildest ride I've ever been on, and that's how I met Ralph. True story. And then later, when we met up with him in Phoenix at the track, he later, going through the Salt River Canyon, lost a wheel off the trailer, and some people helped him get it back together so he could still get to the track on time.
I wonder, when's the last time that a race driver in championship racing, as I still call it, when's the last time a driver towed his car he was going to drive it, to the race? I don't know.
It's been a long time. But he recognized me because I've been to so many races and hang around the pits, whatever. So he didn't know me, but he recognized me because he later told me, he said, well, he said, I recognize you from some of the races. So anyway, it was a wild ride. I'll never forget it.
Well, I'll tell you what. I was always fascinated by his name before I ever came here. I thought, Ralph LaGore.
Uh-huh.
Great name.
Yes.
And so anyway, I spent much of the month of May in 64. And I had not met Ralph, and I'd see him around all the time, and he was in several cars. And then on race morning, I was in the pits, and I'd been all the way down to the north end, and now I'm walking back south again. And I saw LaGore, and he started to walk out. And I thought, oh, well, I don't know if he's going to go in front of me or behind me, but I get closer, and he gets closer, and I didn't know whether to stop or speed up or what, so he could, you know, walk in front of me or behind me or whatever. And he comes up to me, and he says, I haven't met you yet. My name is Ralph LaGore. And I thought, well, I knew that because, you know, you're wearing a uniform with your name written on it. Plus, I knew him anyway. But in those days, drivers that had missed the show used to dress anyway and stand by as a relief driver. But I was really flattered that on the morning of the race, that a driver would come up to me and say, you know, I haven't met you yet.
Yes.
Anyway,
just the other day, by the way, he's out the track. I don't know whether you saw him or not, but I got to talk to him for a while, and he says, you know, I'm 81 now, 81 years old, but he looked fit as a fiddle.
I tell you what, actually, you know, when people say, you know, you remember where you were when Kennedy was assassinated and all that, and a very one you hear frequently is, do you remember where you were when Jim Clark passed away? Well, I actually learned of it through Ralph. It was Easter Sunday, and it was a sprint race at Eldora, and I drove over there and signed in, and I was going down through the pits, and Ralph came up and he says, sorry to hear about your fellow countrymen. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, Jim Clark was killed today. And I could, you know, I could not believe it. I mean, that was just like being hit with a sledgehammer. But anyway, that's I learned that from Ralph. And yeah, he's a great guy. We'll move on and take some other callers here. But what's what a lot of people don't know is he ran NASCAR for about 5 years. And in it was a very different setup in those days because you had some people that the majority would only run one or two races when NASCAR came to your neighborhood, and then there would be those that would cherry pick just the big races, and then you had a few people that made as many races as they could because they could pile the points up. And Ralph in 1953 was 53 or 54. Hesitating on this now. One of those years, he was ninth in NASCAR points. But anyway, let's move on here, and we'll go to Terry. You're up. Thank you for holding. What would you like to hear about?
Hi, Donald. Good evening, and I love the show. It makes my month of May.
Well, thank you very much.
I got a local trivia question. It's such a great engineering school, 65 miles so north of Indianapolis. I was wondering how many Purdue graduates have been race car drivers in the race. I know of one, Pete Halsmer in the 70s, but was there any other Purdue graduates? And I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Oh, all right then. Well, George Souders, who won the race in 1927, was a Purdue undergraduate. At the moment, the only Purdue graduate in the 500 was Pete Halsmer, because Ryan Newman has not driven in the 500. There are several people that participated in the Purdue Go-Kart Grand Prix, and there are a number of people that drove midgets and used to run at the speedrome. And I've got to figure out what year this was. 1 year, Chuck Sprague won the Grand Prix. It might have been 1975, perhaps. Anyway, Chuck Sprague, who became Danny Sullivan's chief mechanic, won in 85, and he's a major player in the Penske organization to this day, he won the Grand Prix. And his crew chief was Grant Newbury, who went to work for True Sports. So in 85, Danny Sullivan won the race, and Chuck Sprague was the chief mechanic. And Bobby Rahal had started on the outside of the front row with Grant Newbury as chief mechanic. And they'd been together at Purdue. So anyway, it was rather rather funny that of all the people that participated in Grand Prix that had a racing connection, when I say Grand Prix, I'm talking Purdue Go-Kart Grand Prix, the only driver in the 500 that went to Purdue was Pete Halsmer, and he never participated in the Grand Prix, and I asked him about that. He said, I was too busy studying for finals, and I didn't want to be distracted, but I think somebody told me that Pete was back here this year, and I haven't seen him for years. But I don't believe there are any other Purdue grads that I can think of that actually drove in the race. Anyway, we thank you for the question, and we're going to take a break here. We'll come back. We'll have about 6-7 minutes, and we'll try and get to some more calls. If you want to join the end of the line, because we're going to be here actually till 8 o'clock on the Network Indiana version of the show, 1-800-603-6453, 1-800-603-6453. We'll be back and take some more. You are listening to The Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. Back with The Talk of Gasoline Alley, and let's go to Sid in Columbus, Ohio. Thank you for hanging on so long. I believe you may be a first-time caller.
No, once earlier this year.
Okay, sorry.
It's okay. Just thinking about the knockout hose clamp special.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
Love that name.
Yeah.
Wanted to talk about Bill Simpson.
Okay.
That's when I was quite young over there, and if I recall, he drove the American Kids Racer.
Yes, he did.
And it was, if I recall, had an unusual shade of pink on that car.
Yep.
And a bit of a small roll cage over at least in one of the practice days.
I don't recall that. I remember the paint job.
It was a very unique looking car. Anyway, he may have just tried it for practice. I don't think it hit the qualifying line that way, but this is the same Bill Simpson that Simpson Safety Equipment, correct?
That is correct.
Anything else you can tell me about him?
Oh, yeah.
And I'm not going to hang up. I like talking.
Oh, all right. Well, that's good. Yeah, the it was silver, and it had the rather different pink and blue. I don't know how to describe them. I mean, they were maybe pastel, but they were not bright colors at all. And I think were the wheels pink or blue? I think they were one of those two colors. But
I believe pink.
Anyway, Bill Simpson, this was his... he'd been at the track since 1970 trying to qualify. And it was a different appearing Bill Simpson in 1974. He was a bit of a freewheeler, or had been, and he wore the long hair and the mustache and the beard, he trimmed up quite a bit when he came in 74. It just seemed to be very, very, very different, and he qualified as Dick Beath's American Kids Racer. And I remember this, that It was a lifetime ambition for him to qualify for the 500. I mean, he had been a drag racer, and a lot of people didn't know if he was serious or not, but he was. And he was an advocate of safety early on. But I remember this. He was at the victory banquet the following night down at the convention center, and he had flown down to Florida. He had a girlfriend, and as soon as the race was over, he flew down to Miami, I think, or somewhere in Florida, and then came back the next afternoon and was at the banquet. And he was very emotional in at the banquet, and he continues to be a very emotional person. Anyway, he claims, and may well have been, the first person to use a parachute to stop a dragster. And I don't know what year that would be, but again, safety advocate very early on, and started the company Safety Auto Equipment.
Now,
Simpson Safety. Pardon?
I had heard a story about him in a folding chair in a fire suit.
Yes, he did that twice.
Was that at Indy?
Well, actually, I think he did it on the infield. He wanted to show. He had a product called carborundum kynol, something like that. Anyway, he wanted to show how much time you had before. You know, that you had several seconds. So I think he doused himself in gasoline, set himself on fire in the uniform, and sat there for several seconds before he had his friends get the extinguishers out. I think he did that on the infield. And next year, or you know, maybe a year or two after that, he was going to do it again, and Clarence Cagle, superintendent of the grounds, found out about it, and said, you can't do that on the ground. So he actually did it across the street at the building that Jim Bob Lubert and his wife have, that's right across from what is now the main entrance.
Where the White Castle used to be?
No. The new entrance.
Oh, the main entrance. Okay. Now.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you, Donald.
All right. Well, thank you very much indeed for the call. And I'll tell you what, we could go to Paul for just a few moments, and Paul, we will take your question, and we may have to answer it on the other side of the hour. But thanks for calling in, and apparently you may have got knocked off a couple of times, but we got you now. So
yeah,
what would you like to hear about?
Can you talk about Ozzy Olsen?
Can I talk about Ozzy Olsen?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. I could talk for a few moments here, but you're going to hear music coming in pretty soon. Ozzy Olsen was, actually had a brother. There was the Norm Olsen special, which ran right after the war. Duke Dinsmore in 1949 drove the Norm Olsen special, and that was Ozzy Olsen's brother. Anyway, he was the CEO of the Swedish Crucible Steel Company, which was the manufacturers of Olsenite, which was the world's largest producer of toilet seats, as I recall. Anyway, it would be unfair to leave him on that note, so we'll come back and talk about his career. Hang with us. We've got to take a break here, and we'll be back on the other side of the hour with more of the Talk of Gasoline Alley. You are listening to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. Back with the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. And for those of you that are listening on 1070 The Fan, we've got about 25 minutes to go, because at 7:30 you will be joining the Fever game, or Fever is in Detroit tonight. And but for those of you that are listening on the various Network Indiana stations, we will continue on until 8 o'clock. Anyway, on the phone we have Paul, who was asking about Ozzy Olsen. And I mentioned that he was the CEO. I don't remember exactly what the title exactly was, but he was the head of the Swedish Crucible Steel Company, which was the manufacturers of Olsenite, and they were the world's largest producer of toilet seats. Anyway,
was he a pretty colorful character?
Yeah, I mean, he was always very well dressed, and normally had several ladies with him, and he used to wear checked slacks and a blazer, and then normally I think he wore a cravat. Now I think about it, I think he wore a cravat all the time, and anyway, Olsenite Eagles, he was the sponsor of Dan Gurney from 67, but not at Indianapolis. He came on at Riverside, and went all the way through to 74 was the last year. And second place with Bobby Unser at the Speedway. But what was really probably the Olsenite Eagles, the biggest accomplishment, or the most famous accomplishment, was Bobby Unser winning the pole at Indianapolis with Track Records, but also winning the pole. Okay, I think there were 10 USAC championship races that year, and I think Bobby won the pole at 8, and I think he set track records each time. And one of them that he didn't win, I remember that there was at Milwaukee. They ended up second fastest. I thought this was rather strange. They would win the pole and then break down. So he wasn't that high in the points. And I remember that they went to for the Milwaukee 200. They qualified and ended up as second fastest to Mario, was on the pole, I believe. I know that Bobby was second. And they complained to USAC that there'd been a surge in the electricity, which gave them a bad reading on the clock, and that their stopwatches had shown that he was on the pole. And when the officials wouldn't budge, then they packed up and went home. And I was really surprised that they would do that. I thought, you could possibly win the race, but not if you're going to load up and leave. But anyway, the other one that he didn't win was Ontario, when Bobby had a problem on the first two qualifying days, and his teammate Jerry Grant won the pole and was the first person to do 200 mile an hour lap. Anyway, at the end of the 74 season, then Ozzy did not renew the sponsorship with Dan Gurney, and that's when Jorgensen Steel came on the scene. Okay, Paul? We thank you very much indeed for the call, and let's go to Mike. You're up.
Hi, Donald. How are you?
Fine, sir. Thanks for hanging on.
Well, I always enjoy your show. Got a couple of questions. One on the qualification time, and also race day timing and scoring. I noticed after qualifications were done, I think you'd mentioned this earlier, the times are exactly from the pole, the fastest to the 33rd, the slowest. How many times has that ever occurred, and when's the last time that has? And also, how is timing and scoring performed now, and how does that differ how it used to be in the past?
Okay, I think there was, I don't know how many times it's gone from fastest to slowest in the 33 or whatever, but there's a couple of occasions when that's happened, when the first weekend got rained out and you had two qualifying days only, and that the fastest qualifier on the second day was slower than the slowest successful qualifier on the first day. So in other words, the speeds descend perfectly from first to last. I think it may have happened in other recent years. Certainly with the new format, with the 11-11-11, it's more likely that you're going to see that. As far as how timing and scoring differs now, there's been a number of different systems, but what they do now is that the cars carry, and I hear it's a transponder, and I hear it's a transmitter. And I've heard people argue it both ways, but anyway, it carries this little box on board the car, and there are a number of lines in the track. The most important one being the start-finish line, but I think there's probably about 8 or 10 points around the track where they've got this line laid in. So you can actually, timing and scoring could actually tell you, how fast the car went down the backstretch and through the turns and so on and so forth. But the important one is start-finish line, and it ends out sends out a signal or does something to cause the time to be recorded, and it's now broken down to 4 decimal places of 1 second. And there's been a number of different systems that have been used over the year, but that's been the one that's been in effect since, well, I know it was going in 1992, and I'm trying to think how much before that. I do remember in practice there was a driver named Guido Dacco, and he had a crew member come out one day with the transponder or transmitter in his pocket and actually sat on the pit wall right at the start-finish line and did a sweep, and then waited 45 seconds and did another sweep so he could actually record a 200-mile-an-hour lap without having been on the track. The officials weren't very happy about that, and one of the problems that they had was the fact that they could not un-record it, and that remained on the speed chart. So I don't know, I think maybe for the whole month, but I know for several days they didn't know how to get that out. They weren't very happy with the fellow that did that. Anyway, that's kind of a simple answer, because basically I could give you some details, but it's very, very complicated to explain how timing and scoring has changed over the years. In the interest of trying to get as many calls as we can in, let's go to Mike in Lafayette. Good evening, Mike.
Hi, Donald. You had a call a few moments ago about Purdue grads that
yes.
Actually participated in the 500.
Yes.
What about Mick Rupp?
Oh, did Mickey Rupp go to Purdue?
I met Mick when he was going to Purdue. Whether he graduated from Purdue, I don't know. But I did meet him when he was here, because he was a member of the Purdue Hot Rod Club.
Oh, yes.
And I remember he had a very nice 32 Ford Roadster.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a good one. I was not aware of that. He was in the news just recently. Somebody sent me a clipping from a newspaper about maybe 3 weeks ago that he had just retired. And I think he's living in Mansfield again.
Right. He was from Ohio and was building the go-karts, the Rupp go-karts.
Yep. He was living in, it was Mansfield, Ohio, which is very close to Mid-Ohio Raceway. But he'd been living in Florida for a number of years, but I think he's now back in Mansfield. He's related to A.J. Watson, which is a little bit of trivia. And he drove in 1-500 and finished 6th. And then I think he went to Milwaukee the next week and got 5th. And then that summer announced his retirement. He did come back and drive some Formula 5000 races, but He had a sixth place finish in his only 500. Okay, well, if he's a Purdue grad, then we'll add another one. We thank you very much indeed for the call. We do need to take a break, and a reminder once again that for those of you that are listening on 1070, we're here for just about another 15 minutes, and then we're going to leave and go to the Fever game at Detroit. But for those of you that are listening on the network Indiana stations around the state, we will be back until 8 o'clock. The number to call is 1-800-603-6453, 1-800-603-6453. We will be back with more on the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. In the outside, in the garage area, it's very quiet because I think they've actually locked the gates because everybody's left, but we're allowed to be here. And so we would like to thank the yellow shirts and security at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway for allowing us to be in here after the place is closed. Anyway, the number to call is 1-800-603-6453, 1-800-603-6453, and let's go to Tom. Good evening.
Donald, it's always a great show.
Thank you.
Wonder if you could tell me a little history about a car called Jones and Maley Special and some of the drivers who drove that car.
Okay, well, there were several Jones and Maley Specials. Actually, the first one was 1930. And Jones and Maley was a car dealer on the east side of Indianapolis, East Washington Street. And Dave Evans finished sixth in 1930 driving a Jones and Maley Special. The next one was 1954, and this is the car that's up on the roof at the Southeastern Southeastern Avenue, the Safety Auto Glass Company, and that car was actually built as an R&D car by Frank Curtis, Myron Drake, and Ted Hallibrand, and some other accessory people. All had a piece of it, and they tried a bunch of experiments, and originally it was supposed to be a supercharged Offie, and they ended up just putting a regular 274 in it, and Bill Homeyer was the driver, and the trivia is that he finished 33rd, but he traveled the greatest distance ever by the first car out of the race. He went 74 laps. We got close to that a few years ago with Greg Ray, who did 67 laps in 2000 and finished 33rd. But anyway, the 74 remains as the record. In 55 and 56, it was driven by Sam Hanks, and Hanks was second in 56. And then in 57, it was Bob Christie drove it to 13th place. In 54, by the way, it was test-topped briefly by Bill Vukovich. Anyway, at the end of the 57 season, Jones and Maley decided to get a newer car, and so the Curtis was sold to several businessmen from Indianapolis, and it became the Safety Auto Glass Special, and it ran for the next several years and never did make the race in their hands. And then eventually it was put up on the roof, and it's there to be seen to this day, except it doesn't look like the Jones and Maley Special anymore. Quinn Apperley built a laydown for them in 1958, which turned out to be the last year that they ran. And Tony Battenhausen was the driver, and Sonny Meyer, Louis Meyer Jr., was the chief mechanic. And Tony Battenhausen had been around forever, but he had never led the 500 before. He got awfully close. I mean, he came within a car length or two in 56, but in 1958 he got to the lead for the first time, and he ended up in fourth place. And at the when the season was over, in fact, this car, being a laydown, only ran Indianapolis, and they sold the car to Bill Anstead, so it returned in 1959 as the Anstead Rotary Special. But Tony Bettenhausen managed to get upside down on the first qualifying day with the car, and it was rebuilt and didn't appear as it did anymore. Anyway, that's pretty much the Jones and Maley story, but I'll do a quick one here that there's a lady that I talked to that was part of the family, and she was telling me that one day in probably 1956 or very early 57, but no later than that, one day a very flashily dressed but polite young man came into the Jones and Maley service department and was calling everybody ma'am and sir, and he had an air conditioner problem with his Cadillac, and it was Elvis Presley. And so they fixed him up, and it probably would have been right after he'd signed with RCA. I don't know why he otherwise would have been here. Sam Phillips sold his Sun contract to RCA, and evidently Elvis was paying a visit here, and it would be pretty soon after that he wouldn't be able to pay a visit here, but apparently he was very polite and waited in the waiting room while they serviced his air conditioner. Anyway, we thank you very much indeed for the call, and let's go to Eric in Vincennes. Eric, good evening.
Good evening, Donald. I had a question for you. I missed the voice of Ron Carroll and Jim Shelton. What are those gentlemen doing now?
Okay, Jim Shelton passed away a few years ago. Ron Carroll is retired, and I saw him about, 3 weeks ago when we had the network breakfast that we have every year, and they invite all of the former voices to come back. And so Bob Lamy and Doug Zink and Chuck Marlowe were all there, along with Ron Carroll. And Ron, as with Howdy Bell, by the way, Ron is, along with the others, is quite a radio historian locally, so he has a lot of great stories, and he's a great for identifying photographs and things of that nature. For many years he was on the broadcast when he was no longer in radio. He actually left, and he was a public relations man for the water company for a number of years.
Wow.
Yeah.
I was not aware of that.
Yeah.
Who is left on the network from the Sid Collins years?
Me.
Wow.
No, actually, let's see. Who else? I don't know if Jerry Baker was on with Sid.
Yeah, I believe so, in 74.
All right, then. But other than that, me.
Wow. That's...
Yeah, I couldn't remember what Baker's first year was. I remember Doug Sink and Chuck Marlowe, I think, started in 65, which was right when I was on it for the first time. I was a guest in 64. And I couldn't remember what Jerry Baker's first year was, but if 74 was the first, then he was on with Sid for three races then, because Sid's last was 76.
Is any of the Sid Collins races available on CD or cassette, do you know, for the public?
Well, let's see. They are, and the answer's coming up here, SpeedwayAudio.com.
Okay.
Yes, Dave Wilson sells them. It's SpeedwayAudio.com.
SpeedwayAudio.com.
Yeah. Okay, we're actually going to have to leave you for now. And.